on our next session. To set the scene for the rest of the day, we've got a couple of speakers to talk, to give us an update just on the economic and political situation. I'll introduce them just before they come up. Tim Bullman, I found out today, ex-Reserve Bank from some of his Reserve Bank colleagues of Australia, but since then joined the World Bank 2007, I think. So that's a good start. And has been working in the World Bank since then and is resident in PNG as a country economist for the World Bank there. Also covers Solomon Islands from the Moresby desk. Tim's going to talk to us about the economic situation set scene today, and I'll introduce Danny once Tim's done his bit. We'll have the two presentations, then we'll have 20 minutes for questions at the back end. Tim.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, everyone. And congratulations to the organisers for this. This is, these events are very useful, I think, for everyone. It's also very humbling as well to be up here telling the story about PNG economic developments, knowing how much experience and knowledge there is in the room. I've been coming to PNG for a little over 3 years, and that's quite a short period compared to a lot of people here. 20 minutes, 30 slides. Hopefully we can send these slides out after because some of them are quite dense. The storyline here is basically a little bit what we know already. The commodity price-driven boom of the past decade seems to be coming to an end, but it's driven a period of strong growth and significant improvements in living standards. But those drivers are waning. So the outlook is mixed. There are a number of factors which offer the potential for upside surprises, but there are also some risks. And so the challenge is how PNG can make better use of the resources that it has. So PNG is coming from a good decade. I think a lot of us already know this story. 2012, sixth year in a row of growth above 6%. Over a decade, growth averaging 5.8%. And when you take out the fact that actual minerals production has been flat in the non-resource economy, growth averaged 7.1% over a decade. So that's real GDP doubling. Government finances have been in improving shape because of, we'll talk about that. And most importantly, this has been supporting improvements in living standards. Yesterday, people showed... Does this have a pointer?
There we go.
So people showed these two bars. This is poverty headcount rates on a material basis. People show the 96 survey and the 2010 survey. In between the two, the World Bank attempted to simulate what poverty would have been given trends in inflation and GDP growth and came up with this number here. When you compare these two, the story is no change. When you take into account the crisis that happened in the late 90s and early 2000s, compared to then, there has actually probably been an improvement in living standards. And you see this in other indicators, such as at least 70% growth in formal sector jobs, and particularly for the 85% of the population in rural areas, improved values in agricultural exports. The driver of this, of course, has been here, the unprecedented and mostly unexpected boom in commodity prices. This is in US dollar terms based to 2005. And what's happened to gold prices in particular blows out the scale. That's flown into higher export values and government revenues, particularly mineral revenues. The strength in hard commodity prices, hard being ores, copper, cobalt, so forth, and energy have attracted huge amounts of foreign direct investment, and the strength in soft commodity prices, cash crops, coffee, coca, copra, and so forth, have been supporting real incomes. And a lot of this as well has been supported by supportive international conditions, in particular cheap corporate credit and international markets. These factors seem to be coming to an end. Next few slides will show you what's been happening in the last 6-9 months in the international economy. Comparing GDP growth forecasts for 2013 for important economies for PNG, basically the outlook for most of these has worsened over the last 6 months. So China, a number of other economies in the region have all seen a downgrade in their growth forecasts. The contrast is a number of, particularly Japan amongst the developed economies. The outlook for 2013 amongst PNG's most important trading partners and sources, demanders of its exports is for weaker growth in 2013 than 2012, which contrasts with some improvement in the developed world. This is trade flows, which had recovered earlier this year from the slowdown last year, but already that's sort of running out of energy. And the other big story at the moment is, of course, what's happening to the cost of capital internationally, with Developing country bond spreads widening in the last month or two as the Fed in particular makes moves to reduce the amount of quantitative easing. Stepping back a little bit, commodity price story. Interesting paper came out recently from David Jacks, NBER, which is this story of looking at commodity prices over the very long run, over a century. Over a century, commodity prices have increased by more than most other prices. But across that trend, you have these periods, these 20-year super cycles. At the moment, the current trend, these are linked to processes of industrialization and urbanization, and the current trend started probably in the mid to late 1990s. It seems to be coming to an end. What's interesting about these trends, though, and particularly this process of industrialization and urbanization, is after that happens, you get a shift from hard commodity prices into the soft commodity prices. So from the hard commodities that PNG exports to the cash crops, for example. PNG can benefit from both of these cycles, although managing these cycles is difficult, as PNG's own history in the 1990s shows. And to support the soft commodity prices as well, this requires a lot of support, more support perhaps than hard commodities from public goods, from the public sector. Now, just you can see the cycle in play here. I like this chart because it just shows you the scale of the global supply response to the increase in commodity prices, a fivefold increase in investment in commodity production, much of which is still to come online. And already this is feeding through to global commodity prices with a decline in the last year and a half or so. Again, this is based in 2005. So what does all this mean for the domestic economy? The challenge for PNG is, I think the only new data we have for 2013 are expenditure warrants. Not even the quarterly economic bulletin tables have come out. But we do have some international indicators and we've got anecdotes, so I'll just talk to that. In terms of the international indicators, already the external balances seem to be weakening. We can see this in the exchange rate and in foreign exchange reserves. The keen is depreciated by, 8.5% in the last 6 months, which compares with 10% for the Aussie dollar, only 2.3% for Indonesian rupiah, which is influenced by similar factors. At the same time, foreign exchange reserves have been run down, $300 million in the last 3 months, $650 million US dollars in the last year. What might be happening, what we can't yet see, is we've got a combination of weakening export receipts, slowing foreign direct investment inflows, and at the same time, imports are probably quite robust, thinking about all the extra government spending and the domestic consumers, domestic businesses spending the retained earnings from the earlier boom. So the other domestic factor, of course, is the fiscal impulse. The government's aiming to offset this slowdown in domestic demand through much higher government spending. This is the 2013 budget, 23% real growth compared to 9% real growth in earlier years. And I just want to contrast what was recommended in the last Article 4 with what actually happened. But if we look at spending data for the first quarter and then for April, the actual rate of disbursements, little change from previous years. So this is first quarter spending. This is April's multiplied by 3. And this is what the government would have to spend per quarter for the rest of the year to meet this year's budget. This is for the total budget. I haven't done the breakdown by recurrent and development yet. So you can see that, you know, for the year of implementation, there's still a lot more implementing to do. So because we don't have data, if you want to pull this all together into a story, you end up with a page of bullet points like this. So the story here is slower growth or weakening externally reliant and foreign direct investment reliant sectors. For example, industrial suppliers are reporting slower demand, or even lower demand than a year ago. But again, this contrasts with the supply constraints that existed in 2010 and 2011 in these sectors and for these firms. Meanwhile, domestic economy seems to be a mixed picture. Firms which are supplying domestic consumers continue to invest in new supply and new capacity just to keep pace with demand. Other indicators, such as the volume of financial transactions that the banks report, are slowing or even lower than a year ago. So what are we bringing all this together? We would stick with an expectation of about 4% growth for 2013. This contrasts with Treasury expecting 6%. BPNG's liaison suggests something a bit weaker than Treasury, and if you talk to the private sector, they're weaker still. It's important in thinking about growth, and there are some confusions here. The level of activity is still at an historical high. This is different from the change in that level of activity. And also the fact that some things are costing more in value doesn't mean there's actually more activity occurring. The $4 billion increase in the cost of LNG, PNG LNG rather, doesn't mean that there's more construction activity that's attached to that $4 billion. Looking ahead for the next year or two, well, first of all, where are the next new big sources of foreign direct investment? And it's harder to see this in the commodity sectors than the case a couple of years ago. One point is on what's happened to international commodity prices and the increase in cost of these investments. Another point is that PNG is more reliant than most other countries on the international capital markets to fund these foreign direct investments. This is showing you private external debt, and a lot of this is attached to commodity investments. And so as international financing conditions tighten, it's going to be harder for firms to find the finance to fund new resource projects. And we're already seeing this in terms of delayed investment decisions, for example, in Wafi. The second source of demand at the moment is the public sector. The medium-term fiscal strategy requires real per capita spending to decline for the next 4 years to get the budget back to balance in 2017. And that's already based on pretty optimistic revenue forecasts and commodity price forecasts. For example, 2014, the budget's forecasting gold at $1,600. This morning it was $1,200, similarly for copper. So slower revenue growth, if the MTFS and the medium-term debt strategy are going to be achieved, would require an even sharper slowdown in spending. So the question is there a risk here that PNG will repeat itself? These kind of ugly graphs, I think, are super interesting. What we did is we went through the old budget papers and looked at forecasts over the five-year horizon through the 90s, thinking back to the story of what happened in the early 90s when PNG had unsustainable public finances, which ended up in this public debt blowout, and the story. The story then is revenue forecasts were a little bit optimistic, but not overly so. What happened was that expenditure was way above what was budgeted. The way to read these lines, the black is the actual, the lines here are the forecasts from each budget, and the budget's taken at that point. So that's the 1990 budget, what was forecast for expenditure. The other thing that I think is interesting is to contrast the revenue projections in this year's budget with previous years. Okay, so looking in the next few years, I don't think the story from 6 months ago changes particularly, which is a marked slowdown in the non-resource economy, but aggregate GDP looking pretty solid because of the impact of LNG construction. And then these are from this year's budget papers. Treasury was forecasting 20-25% increase in real GDP because of the start of gas flowing down the gas pipeline. And that number might actually be substantially higher for various technical reasons. How do you add a British thermal unit of gas to a kilogram of coffee and a ton of copper to work out real GDP? This is not the most optimistic story. That's not the message we want people to take away. We see three other opportunities here which are quite linked as to what can happen next and what needs to happen next if PNG is to achieve its potential for there to be sustained, inclusive growth. The storyline here basically is we need to tackle what makes it hard to do business for Papua New Guinean firms. Complementing this is the opportunities that exist in the informal sector. And supporting all of this is the role of the public sector, providing complementary goods and services, public goods and services. An analogy I like, so there's a lot of talk at the moment about protectionist measures and tax holidays. If bid PNG succeeds and PNG joins the NRL, it's not to ask all the other teams to forfeit their games. It's to lift up the quality of the PNG team. And the business sector is kind of the same process, right? This is doing business. PNG ranks middling, sort of lower group. If we look at the reforms in the last year, there's nothing really that would advance this. And the storyline is basically small and medium enterprises are the largest source of employment and incomes. There are simple things that can be done which are a lot cheaper for both consumers and the government than providing subsidies to improve competition for Papua New Guinean businesses. A great example recently is what's happened with ISP. Where breaking the monopoly for telecom on the internet gateway has immediately led to cheaper services and supporting PNG ISP firms. You could tell a similar story probably on trade and logistics. Part of the story here is expensive infrastructure, but there's probably a lot of regulation and business environment issues that would also reduce the cost of logistics. Excuse me. Secondly, informality. This comes from, I don't know if John Gibson presented this earlier in the week, but looking at the HIS, you can see a trend that you see in many other countries as urbanisation occurs, which is an increase in the informal sector. Old development theory says you should expect the opposite, that urbanisation and formalisation are part of the same process. But in many countries at this income level, this is the pattern you see. The share of people working in wage jobs has declined. The share of people not in the labour force has also declined. And they've all moved into informal sector jobs. This is true for men. For women, there's an even stronger movement from not in the labour force into wage jobs and the informal sector as well. And if we think about what's likely to happen to a lot of the LNG workers, the 6,000-8,000 workers who will lose their jobs as the LNG construction process ends, they're likely to go into the informal sector. So the question is what we can do to support what's happening there and the opportunities that this offers for access to better incomes, particularly in urban areas. And the story that's emerging there is one of three I's: integration, intervention, and institutions. Integration between the formal and informal sector, so there isn't a bright line that makes it hard for firms to jump between the two. Intervention to supply the services that the informal sector needs, utilities, security, and institutions that support the informal sector, so, training programs, for example, for businesses or entrepreneurs. And the third point is you talk to businesses across PNG, and the thing that they complained about, it's not the stronger kina, it's not tax rates, it's access to educated workers. And workers, when they get sick, they come back from hospital better. And reliable electricity supply. Here I'm just picking up, I know we're talking about some of the expenditure tracking work later, but here I'm just picking up on health sector. PNG rates below where it should be, given its income in terms of infant mortality for this one. You can see this across a range of indicators. The level of inputs per capita is lower than other comparator countries as well. And access, particularly on the public side, is fairly unequal. Now, the story here, a lot of this is probably about resource allocation, but it's also about the processes that actually ensure those resources reach their intended targets. This is taken from work that Alan Cairns has done, who works also with the NEFC, looking at when health function grants are dispersed. This is, the scale here is between 0 and 100% of the health function grants to each of these provinces, and these are the different years. And what you're seeing, if anything, is a worsening in the release of these grants. So that's the story here, basically. For more on this, there's the global story. We'll bring out another PNG economic briefing the next couple of months. Thanks.
Well, thanks for that, Tim. It's good to hear we've got some weaker growth in partner countries, falling commodity prices, external balances going down, and need for fiscal tightening on the horizon. That's a recipe for some strong economic growth, I'm sure. But we'll see what plays out, much like the NRL bid. But after that sort of optimistic scenario from Tim, we'll see if Denny can give us something, if the story on the political side is similarly optimistic or differently optimistic. Denny Tuk and I studied law and business at the University of Waikato. While in New Zealand, he was the first Papua New Guinean to be elected as the student council president at a New Zealand university. He also served on the university council as well. Since then, he's established himself as one of PNG's leading social media commentators. He's regularly picked up in the Australian and New Zealand media, and has also been picked up in international places like The Economist and The New York Times and the BBC. So I'm going to hand over to Denny for an update on the political situation to complement Tim's presentation.
Something different from economics, politics. When I was first approached by Stephen and the team to come and to the PNG and Pacific update and talk about politics, to be honest, I thought that I might simply present a couple of slides, usually representing the picture of PNG politics, which is quite often related to a circus. But I think and I do believe that there's much that we can learn from PNG politics, And the more you look into it, the more lessons one can glean out. So that's sort of the message that I'd like to follow on through here, and hopefully by the end of my little presentation, we'd have looked a bit closer into some of the lessons that we can learn from PMD politics, and not so much the negatives. 1026, by the way, was an estimation. I'm not sure how close I was. it's quite difficult to generate an overview or a presentation on the theme of PNG politics for an audience such as yourselves, because for one, the topic of PNG politics is varies in terms of its depth, and also your understanding as an audience of the different issues to do with Papua New Guinea as a nation, social, political, economic, may vary as well. So what I decided to do was to do a general overview of PNG politics, starting with the post-election period from 2012. I want to talk a bit about the actors, the key actors which were involved after the national election and who we see now carrying the mandate of our national government. I want to touch a bit on the Aotearoa Accord, which of course we heard previously from our Vice-Chancellor, and then we'll move on to a bit more in-depth detail on the current political environment, particularly around the numbers game in terms of what that means for the current makeup of our parliament. Also, a bit of qualitative analysis in terms of language, and this is an interesting topic, and it's largely based on a bit of work I did, which was intended to be presented at Deakin's PNG Symposium earlier this year in April, but I didn't manage to do that because I got sick, unfortunately. So I want to touch a bit about that, and actually, I believe it is quite important that we do look at the language that is used in PNG politics, particularly around the marketing material that we see in campaigns, because the language that is used is highly emotive, and it has a rollover effect to the perceptions of how our people perceive our MPs and also what they expect from our MPs. So it's something that I'd like to touch on. Also, look into to some challenges that I think are important to mention. And finally, I'm wrapping up with the future of PNG politics, some predictions. I may be wrong, but there are some predictions that I'd like to make as well. Now, just quickly, this election campaign poster, just for you, I have a pointer. No, that was the wrong one. That wasn't good. Here we go. In the
top,
middle?
Top.
Bottom.
Anyways, what we see here is a typical election campaign poster of a candidate, Mr. Moses Namabulisa, and you would have seen some of these election campaign posters outside, brought here. This one's quite interesting. There's a bit of symbolism here that I want to talk a bit about, particularly in regards to the individual Moses, who I did meet. I followed the... I took time off work during the national election and for about 2.5 months for the elections in Papua New Guinea. So Moses is an interesting character. As you will see, he's not actually endorsed by any particular political party. At the bottom of that campaign poster, he's endorsed by the Simple People of Goroka, Eastern Highlands Province. And he also has the interesting nickname, 10 Kilo. Now, I had heard of this Mr. 10 Kilo Man when I was up in Goroka and Kainantu throughout the Eastern Highlands Province, and I thought, who is this 10 Kilo Man? I had to meet him. He sounded like a very interesting fellow. And Moses got his 10 Kilo nickname as a result of his side business, which he did, which was simply buying 10 kilo rice bags from a source of supply and then reducing that into smaller bags and sell it on to small communities in the rural districts of Eastern Highlands. But he campaigned on 10 kilo, and a lot of people voted for him. He actually, thanks to second and third preference votes, made it all the way up to the top 8 in terms of the Eastern Highlands provincial government. He lost out eventually to Honourable Governor Julie Sosso, and also a couple of millionaires. So he did very well for a man who had very little education, no backup in terms of political party, and his little slogan down there, if you can read Tokusin, is Trai Mangi Long Peles, which means try someone from the village. This here is one of my favourite billboards of the election, of the election period. And there's a couple of reasons for that, without stating the obvious. But I think primarily because of the enduring premise of the message that it has on the billboard. And not only that, I think secondly, also because that this message is transnational. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, if you are, if you're interested in politics and you vote for someone, then somewhere along the line you may relate to David. Now, I'm sure there's a couple of Australian voters in here who probably feel the same way too right now in terms of what's going on. But there's a second and more important reason why I included this particular photo, and that's because of the capitalized word action there. And I'll come back to this later on in my presentation. But I just want you, as we go along in the presentation, I just want you to think a bit about the emotive connotations of this particular word action, because it featured predominantly throughout election 2012. Key actors, pre, during, and post-election. Now, these are just some of, all of these men are individuals, are leaders of their respective political parties. I won't go through all of the details of the political parties because I don't want to bore you with all that. But the key actors, as we can see, we have Peter O'Neill, People's National Congress. Up there we have his opposition, Belinda Nama, with his famous one-finger salute. And then at the bottom there, in a line across, we have Sir Julius Chan from PPP. We have Pius Winty from PDM. Patrick Crutch from National Alliance. We have William Duma from URP. Pavas Pakop from SDP. We have Peter Ipitas from PP. And then the bottom right corner there, we have Dr. Alan Marat, who is from the MLP. The important thing, the three key points that I want you to get away from this particular slide, and first of all, is the significance of the middleman there, Mr. Don Folia, who is the member for Kandap. Now, I sort of gave him a bit of prominence there under both the leader of the government and the opposition, because he holds the second highest number of seats in cabinet, did very well in terms of his party, the Triumph Heritage and Empowerment Party, or the party. And also, this was confirmed about a week ago when we both had our Prime Minister away in Indonesia, went on state delegation, and the Deputy Prime Minister, Leo Dion, also away too, out of the country. And the responsibility of acting Prime Minister fell to Don Polev. It's also important to note that our Deputy Prime Minister is actually the Deputy Leader of the party. So in terms of seniority, he actually comes underneath Don Polev. And I think one of the key reasons why we saw Don Polev not given the chance to be Deputy Prime Minister was because of a very conscious decision to make a fair representation of our provincial and regional makeup in terms of our ethnic tribes. One other point I'd like to make, all of these men, apart from Patrick Powers and Alan Marat, all during the course of the election put their hands up very publicly, claiming that they were the next Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea. Only one got the job. Alatau Accord. Now, this is the fundamental coalition document which during the process of the formation of government, the key political party signed, and ended up being Peter O'Neill leading this. Obviously, it was signed in Alatau, hence the name. There are a few key points here. I mean, it was formed a government based on the spirit of reconciliation, unity, and trust. It's particularly important coming out of the period of instability that we had in terms of the political impasse. So that was one of the key points which was talked about in Alatau. They allocated the ministries at a ratio of 3-1, therefore after taking into account gender, provincial and regional representation. All partners agreed and committed to serve in a full term of 5 years. Now, this particular line has been involved in previous accords and have been committed to in full, so it'll be interesting to see, particularly over the course of the next four years, how exactly the signatories to that accord will follow through with their commitment. And finally, the last point there, PM has the prerogative to discipline the other ministers. He has the prerogative. He hasn't yet done that. He probably should have by now. There's a couple of ministers who have been misbehaving, but that is something that is yet to be seen. A key point on this is that I actually haven't seen the Alatau Accord. I'll be interested to see if, Vice-Chancellor, you have actually seen it, because As far as I know, it's a bit of a mythical document, a bit like the election petition that was apparently circulated in Canberra, in Parliament there a couple of days ago. But it's a document which I did push hard to get, particularly when I was doing some consultation with IHS Jaynes, and to much no avail, couldn't find it. But it is an important document in terms of the founding of the government and where we go from now. Briefly, a look at the numbers, and I mean, some of you will be well aware of what's going on. But I would like to highlight particularly the situation. Right after the election finished, Peter O'Neill from the PNC won 27 seats. Mbelinama, his main contender, the opposition, sorry, to the Prime Minister seat, he won 8 seats. After they bargained and bribed and possibly barricaded other winning MPs in different rooms, the numbers that they had was 45 in Peter O'Neill's coalition, and Mbelinama managed to get 23. As of now, the number that we see now in PNC is 75, and PNG Party is 5. The important thing to note here is that the PNC is the primary party in government, and the PNG Party is the primary party in the opposition. And in fact, our total number of MPs in our opposition right now is at 6. I think it is at 6. Which is a bit of a problem, because not only is another state the obvious in terms of accountability issues on the floor of parliament, maintaining control from the executive, but not very many people know this, but constitutionally, Mbelinama is now restricted in terms of producing a vote of no confidence as a result of his lack of numbers. You need 1/10 of parliament to present a vote of no confidence. He doesn't have the numbers. He may be able to have the numbers in the future, I don't know. But at the moment, it's not possible for the opposition to table a vote of no confidence in parliament. The key issue here is the increase in power of the executive. And for those of you who were here earlier this week, you would have heard Grant Harrison talk a bit about his experience in PNG with the Centre for Democratic Institution, I do believe. He had a very good visual representation of the diminishing legislator overview of the executive power held by our executive. And the key points that he highlighted, which is very good, was the amendments which we see currently in Parliament to the increase in the grace period for voting on confidence, also possible amendments to decrease in the number of sitting days. This is a constitutional amendment of our Parliament, and also increase in the number of weeks required for a vote of no confidence if tabled to be tabled. At the moment, it sits at 1 week, I do believe. There's a current amendment proposing that to increase that period from 1 week to 2, 3, I don't know how many weeks. So the whole intent is that the current executive in PNG is very powerful compared to the other two arms, separation of powers, and it is a great concern, particularly as our own representatives in Parliament voted quite almost unanimously, in fact, in supporting the extension of the vote of no confidence period, which was befuddling, but they did that. So, in effect, they've actually voted to reduce their own influence on Parliament and their own ability to check our executive. Now on to language and the word action. And this is a bit of qualitative analysis I'd like to just touch on, and particularly if you were at the Deakin Symposium. It was very interesting to hear a number of presentations from Papua New Guineans who had come down to Deakin and talk a bit about the change in labelling of leadership and the leadership types that we see in PNG and what I like to call PNG 2.0 speech. You know, we all know, we've all heard about Melanesia big men, but to be honest, that's probably the concept of the big man is still present and will always be present, I believe. But we are seeing an evolution of descriptions and the categorizing of silos of types of leadership in PNG, focusing on particular tribes, segments, demographics. So, for example, we've got, you know, boss man, leader man, sawem man, chief. Chief's a good one. I always make the joke that our Logohood, our national award system, which is called the Logohood Awards, gives the title chief and grand chief. And I've always thought that we'll eventually come to the point where we'll need some sort of differentiation and maybe have a new award called the Chief of Chiefs or the Chief of Grand Chiefs. That's a little joke. Daddy Boss is also another one, Exum Governor. Now, this is a very common one, and up here I've got a photo of the original Exum Governor. And the reason why he is the original is because coming from the governor of the Anger province, there's very limited resources in terms of his provincial capability. So he's now in his fifth term of parliament. So he's been around, this will be his 20th year in parliament. And one of his key goals while being the member for Enga was to invest in human capital. And he's done it very well. He's done it exceptionally well. And we already seen the results. A lot of our peers coming through university are from Enga, young people. They're already increasing their influence in terms of getting better paid jobs in Papua New Guinea and elsewhere as well. But this is where the term action governor came from, in effect of being someone who does something that presents, an action which people recognize. In other words, something tangible, something that people can see, touch, feel, appreciate, understand, and can directly associate, as a result of them giving their vote to an individual in Parliament. Action governor has been, the term has also now part of the vocabulary in Tokpisin, action governor, and the bottom right there, I have another term there, action nalia. So we've gone from English to Tokpisin, and we've gone to now to traditional local languages. Nalia is a word from the local Simbu and Jiwaka language. It simply means man, or mangi in Tokpisin, or boy. It just means an action man in their language. And action nalia in particular is an interesting term because it was self-given to the former member for North Wagi, Benjamin Wool. And if you go to Jiwaka and Simbu, you will know very well that he called himself action nalia, or the man who was an action man. But he changed that name in the election. He called a press conference, and I was there at the press conference. It was in the middle of buns in Jiwaka, nothing but coffee trees around. And he called this press conference, and he asked the media to stop calling him Exxon Nale and to call him a new name, ATM. True story. It happened. I was there. And it was reported widely in the PNG media, and, I mean, obviously, connotations with an ATM and a member of parliament. I think about 6 months, no, but 2 months after that, he was arrested for bribery. Not surprising there. And he didn't win back his seat. So he's, I'm not sure what he's doing now. The thing that I really want to get into, I guess, the gist of the language is that when we talk about the word action was the most common word in election marketing in 2012. Everybody was using this word action. And it creates a perception and almost a expectation amongst our people that the reason why they are voting for their representative in parliament is so that they can gain something back from them. And it's not a new concept. I mean, it's very visible in PNG politics and also Melanesian politics for that matter. But what this creates is that it promotes an MP mentality of being project managers, because the fundamental reason, if they want to get back or hold onto the seat in the next election, they need to convince their electorate that they've done something. And the best or the most efficient way to do that in Papua New Guinea is to deliver a tangible product or service or even goods that people appreciate and can associate with you or with him or her as doing so. The thing with this is that one of the problems that the media propagates the myth. And what I mean by that is that it's very often in PNG media you see stories about, for example, I use Peter O'Neill. Peter O'Neill donated 500,000 kina to a certain charity or cause. So they personalize the political distribution of funds. The money isn't Peter O'Neill's money, it's the state's money. But in the people's perception of how it's presented in the media, and it's never changed, it's been this way for God knows how many years, people have built up an expectation and an understanding that, yes, it's his money, he's given it out to us, and we like him for that. The other way that this myth is propagated throughout society is that MPs take advantage of government funds and associate the image with it. So it's not unusual to see, for example, when I was in Kanyantu, there was an ambulance there, and not only did it have the word ambulance, but it had a bigger and larger and brighter photo of the local MP next to it. And there were two of those. And I think one of the more annoying examples that I've come across, and there's been a number of them, for those of you who have downloaded the PNG 2012 national budget, the first thing you will look at as you open up the national budget is a one-page photograph of the Minister for Treasury. Now, I don't know any other country in the world where you would see such a huge visual depiction of the Minister.
Time's nearly up.
Is it?
Yeah.
Anyways,
so the point is that here we go. Here's a good example. This is a letter to the editor as of yesterday, I think it was. And just read it. Where's the member for Bow District, which we have signed contract with him to fight for goods and services in the floor of Parliament and all sorts of his promises? This is verbatim. So we're not talking about an idea that's maybe 10, 15 years old. This is yesterday. It's pervasive in our society. It's still there. I tried to come up with a better way to sort of encapsulate the challenges facing PNG politics, particularly from a politician perspective. And sometimes we do take the mickey out of our MPs, but at the same time, this is a fair point. This is a tweet that I tweeted earlier in February, I do believe. As you'll see, it's true. You know, political accountability, they have it very easy. Socially, they have it too hard. And some MPs will not and can't cope with that additional pressure. Some MPs can. Some of the challenges leading in terms of politics and PNG in general speaking is corruption. This here, you'll read through that, is an exceptional example of corruption in PNG from a practical level. Now, the funny thing is that at the last point, the fourth bullet point, is probably the only really, sentence qualified to be part of the job description. The previous three are all focused on corruption in Papua New Guinea and sort of asking the applicants to take into consideration corruption and law and governments. This, by the way, is by Rubal Shippen. They've since, Queen fame, they've since been much well aligned. The future, almost finished here, briefly. LNG and elections, national by-elections, we are hosting right now. LNG elections have started. Some seats have already been declared. We have seen a greater uptake of female representation in LNG elections than we have seen in national election, which is a good thing. We have started our first national by-election. This is almost 1 year on from the end of the election, and that's the Angaram Open. They're currently processing with that. Election petitions for our national elections are still ongoing. The process is not complete. In fact, we have some senior members of our cabinet who will be facing the court. Most notably is Don Poilier. And if you're interested in numbers and figures of how you win politics in PNG, I recommend the member for Kandap. Look at where he won. I wrote a great article about it on my blog. There were 27 candidates who scored zero votes. Somehow he managed to score the rest of them. But that's important to know to vote. Something else to note is the further voter no confidence constitutional amendments. That's a big issue that's coming up, and I do hope that it is played predominantly in our public discourse. The creation of ICAC is another important point, Independent Commission Against Corruption. We will be all familiar with Mr. Sam Coyne and the task force sweep. The intention, I was talking to Sam a couple of days about this, the intention is for task force sweep to become transitioned into ICAC as a permanent body. That hasn't yet happened. And in addition, Sam hasn't received his promised 20 million kina allocation from the budget yet. So he's operating on a shoestring budget, but he's doing excellent work. Other points worth noting is the PNG Defence White Paper. And also, there will be a cabinet reshuffle before September. That's one prediction I'll make. I was expecting it a bit earlier for a couple of reasons. A couple of ministers have been misbehaving. But I think Peter O'Neill has had enough with a number of ministers in key sectors that haven't been delivering. So I'm sorry about the presentation. It's very generalized and not very in detail. But if you do have more questions, I'm more than happy to answer them. And thank you.
Excellent presentation. So I just wanted to ask Tim, you didn't mention the Sovereign Wealth Fund, and I wanted to ask you what is happening to the Sovereign Wealth Fund.
Are we pulling questions?
I've taken one.
Okay.
Quick answers. There's still a group that's working. I think actually there's an IMF mission that arrives next week to work with the Sovereign Wealth Fund working group. So they're continuing to prepare the legislation, the administrative processes, everything around the Sovereign Wealth Fund organic law. There are other ideas which are floating around as to how the Sovereign Wealth Fund might be structured, what its role might be, how it might integrate into the budget, and where the funds might be held. But there are different perspectives and you ask different people and they'll say different things. But the core group have been working on this for a couple of years now and continuing with their work.
Certainly there are ways to do that, and I think as a second point to that, it may even be more effective going through that way than going through departments and bureaucracy and getting the money spent on administration by trying to get the people that's nothing tangible. So there's certainly methods that can be utilised to do that, and I think what comes immediately to mind are Papua New Guinea organised NGOs, and there's a lot of them. There's a lot of NGOs. The NGO sector in Papua New Guinea is significant. They do a lot of good work. I'm not just talking about the churches or church-based organisations. Increasingly, I think particularly over the last 5 years, if you were to look at the number of NGOs which were secular, you'd be amazed at the number that have been started up in the NGO, particularly from small groups of people who have common interest in addressing an issue that they feel important to them. So I think that would be my, a good starting point would be contacting those groups. They're well motivated, they know what they want, they know what they want to do, easily managed.
I guess there are two points. One is you think of the role of the Sovereign Wealth Fund. It would have been great if, like you say, this existed a decade ago. PNG managed to smooth out some of the revenue surprises through the use of trust accounts and through a reasonably strong medium-term fiscal rule that it followed mostly during that period. And that was very supportive when commodity prices weakened in 2009. Because the funds were held onshore, it had impacts on the domestic liquidity and the quasi-fiscal cost for the amount of money, the government money that was sitting in the domestic banking system. The Sovereign Wealth Fund that's proposed has got a number of advantages, a number of attractions to it. Based on baseline revenue projections, under the current rules, it's unlikely to have any money in the stabilisation fund for some years, probably until early next decade. But I think the argument that the team who've been working on this have made is, look, you have the thinking around this. You have the political motivation to push this through, and they've already made there has been a consensus around establishing a Sovereign Wealth Fund, so to make the most of that, set up the institution that is robust and that works now while that window's there. And when revenues arrive, and maybe there are some of these positive surprises could work out, you have an institution that's there, that's operating, and that will smooth out the uncertainty and volatility in mineral revenues that's such an issue for PNG and other resource countries. If that political window closes, then this is something that could sit for a while without necessarily damaging public revenues or the advantages that it would bring in the short term. So if you could do it now, do it. But if it's going to be less than ideal, then it probably doesn't matter if it sits for a few years.
Thank you both. That's very excellent. fascinating presentations. It seems to me that one of the, perhaps the largest key risk going forward, both for the economy in the long run, as well as for the sort of social and political environment in PNG, is the failure of the PNG bureaucracy to be able to deliver services on the ground. We've heard, I guess, this morning about some of the challenges involved in doing that. How do we better ensure that the bureaucracy is able to take its, you know, admittedly limited resources and use them more efficiently? And how do we ensure that the political class are able to discipline them to have that occur, and that feedback mechanism flows all the way through to the people? It was heartening to see, I guess, some improvements in terms of the accountability of the service on that level.
Yeah, it's a challenging question. You know, there's no really easy answer to it. I think, you know, first and foremost, there's a very good paper actually I was talking to, his name, but there's a very good 2004 paper by WASAID, focused on the public service fiduciary in PNG, and it was based on interviews of senior public servants, public union public servants, and their views of how things have changed. Read that for one, it's very good. I think a lot of us forget about the importance of that particular paper. Another paper I'd recommend is Francis Fukuyama's overview of the second PNG, another one to read as well. But I guess as a general response, there's no easy answer to it. What I would say is that we've come to the point where the public machinery in PNG has been depleted, it is inefficient, and possibly one of the ways to look at strengthening the capacity that we have is to help MPs better understand that the public service is there to help them and not necessarily there not to help them. So quite often in PNG we see a lot of conflict between certain MPs, ministers, local level government officials and our folks in the public service. And that usually ends up pretty stressful situations. People get sacked, turned around and whatnot. So I think a greater working relationship as we had at the time of independence up to the 1980s, where we had a very strong public machinery service and we had MPs that really understood the idea of building a Papua New Guinea in a national concept. That national consciousness in terms of our leaders is no longer there. You know, we've lost that. We need to regain the ability to think on a national level, and that's the way forward.
We're going to take several comments at once. First of us, at the back, at the other back, and
to the... Just a question, Danny, on parties and the roles of parties. It's always the question in PNG is whether parties really matter. Have you seen any change? There's sort of been a renewed push by the political parties commissioner to hold them to account. In the last election, there was certainly some of the larger parties you saw a certain element of professionalisation in some of their campaign materials. Do you think some of that flows through to the power shift between, you know, parties and their MPs at all? Have you seen any of that?
Jacinta
Marua
from the Papua New Guinea High Commission. Thank you for the presentation. Just a clarification on the first question, I think, that was posed by, what was it, colleague down the front there? The second. Just a clarification. Donor funds do not go to the management or administration of government departments, and that must be understood. I think the question that we must pose here is, when and how do we use the organizations that are based in Papua New Guinea that are established by Papua New Guineans, and I mean these organizations, civil society organizations, when are the donor agencies going to use them to implement the projects or the initiatives then that actually as a result of those institutions in Papua New Guinea? I think that is where we should come from. But first and foremost is that donor funds do not go to the administration and management of government departments.
Joint question for Tim and Danny. The state of statistics in PNG has been poor for a long time now. Tim, I was just wondering if you could reflect on the accuracy of our ability to do quality macroeconomic monitoring in PNG based on those statistics. And Danny, I was wondering if you could just comment on why has it been in PNG that the political demand for quality information on what's going on in the economy and the population at large has been so low? Why politicians don't demand better information for their policymakers?
the paper that Danny just mentioned about public service perceptions was published by Jose late last year. The author was a woman called Lynn Piper, P-I-E-P-E-R, I think it is.
And she was published by the ANU, by the Development Policy Centre.
Well, we had a blog and the papers on the Aussie.
No, it's not on it's on our website.
It's a must read. 2 weeks ago we had the current speaker of the PNG Parliament speak here at CDI. He said that MPs should not be members of the executive distributing resources. They should not be ATMs. Parliament should be working effectively with strong committees. People should think about national issues. You've got to get MPs out of this process of dispersing funds and the impact that has had on public expectations on what is the role of an MP. All the points that Danny made very well today. What chance do you think the Speaker Zurino has of actually getting these reforms through Parliament and getting the funding for there to be a stronger Parliament with the staffing to have a decent committee and decent policy discussions about anything?
Okay. Tim, dedicate a couple of minutes each to
answer. Yeah. Sure. Statistics, great question. I didn't mention CPI. That is actually a statistic which is available for 2013, but it's increasingly downward biased. The education component of the CPI is now set at zero after they introduced fee-free education. People still pay fees. You pay project fees. Education still costs money. You talk to any family in PNG, but the CPI records it as zero, which is actually biasing down the whole CPI, and that's true of other components. The implication of this, if your wages are set or adjusted according to the CPI, your wages are going to be adjusted by less because the true movements in the cost of living is less than the CPI's reporting. If you're the central bank trying to manage monetary policy, which is about managing price inflation, then you think or you're being told that the rate of price growth is less than it actually is. So you run policy that's excessively loose, which brings all sorts of issues in terms of macro stability in the longer run. Meanwhile, GDP data have been put together by Treasury and the central bank from firm liaison. There are no reliable macro data. At some point, this starts to have implications for PNG standing in international institutions. It's as a member of the IMF and World Bank and the UN system, there are reporting obligations, and PNG can't meet those reporting obligations. This starts to become a serious issue in terms of being able to frame policy that supports economic development in Papua New Guinea. I'll let Danny answer why that's the case, why it hasn't been fixed yet.
Thanks, Tim. You get a few comments on macro statistics, you're a better man than me.
The a point to make as well, it's not a question of capacity necessarily. In a lot, many different development partners, SBC, the bank, the AusAid, everyone has tried to provide capacity support to the NSO, and we see the impact that's had.
Just three questions. I'll start at the top there in regards to the question was on political parties and the developments, I think it was. You were absolutely right. We did see a huge transformation in terms of the professionalism and the extent to which some of our political parties were going to in terms of marketing during the national election 2012. I think that the Commission of the Integrity of Political Parties and Candidates, they have a very strong intent to do well in terms of regulating and encouraging stronger political parties. But the challenge is on actually achieving that. And we've already seen a precedent set where the previous OLEPAC was ruled to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So there's a lot of ideas about that. But I think the primary route which Dr. Alphonse Gill is going down is encouraging strong parties. So not necessarily limiting parties, but I noticed that I think just a couple of days ago, the first amendments to proposed amendments were accepted by our cabinet. A couple of them were rejected. But the key ones which were accepted were along the lines of demanding political parties to endorse in more than one electorate. So that the intent of that is to stop political parties to be created out of the blue, and then you just run for one electorate, and that's that. So that was accepted. Another one which was accepted was demanding political parties to compulsorily have 1/10 of the candidates to be female. That was accepted by NEC. The one which was rejected was, I think from memory, was about allowing MPs to crisscross on the floor of Parliament prior to formation of government. That was an old one. It was submitted. It was rejected again. Key points, they were accepted by the Cabinet. They haven't been amended in our law. So overall, generally speaking, there is a driving factor there to try to improve our political party system. As we all know here, PNG politics isn't based on ideology, nothing at all, like we do have in Labour and whatnot. So it's a very different set of politics, but it can work. The challenge is getting it right, getting the key players to agree to the set of rules, and to keep to the set of rules and to implement it. The second question, I think, over here was about political demand for greater information, particularly from our politicians in terms of policy making. I don't know why. I don't know why they haven't requested that. I'm sure some have, and I know that Speaker Theo Zurinok is a big believer in improving the process of parliamentary democracy, not so much in terms of information process to the public, but also within Parliament, and particularly within our parliamentary committees. I mean, those of us here know very well the importance of parliamentary committees and the process of how to consult with the public, and from there we see the bills and whatnot. In Papua New Guinea, we have about 34 parliamentary committees. These are established parliamentary committees, and we have 3 of them functioning. So it's a huge issue, and politicians past, present, haven't identified the significance of having those parties, those committees functioning, and being part of it. I know that there are some very active members of Parliament who do go to these meetings and others who don't really care about them. So, hopefully that is improved, and I do know that the European Union is pushing for an open, transparent Parliament project, which is all about allowing for more information from Parliament to be disseminated to the populace, which is important as well. The third question, I think, was about Parliament through for, oh, it was more of a commentary bill, I think it was. Yeah.
Okay. We should call a halt here. Please start back. Tim, Denny, really interesting presentations that have set the scene for some more detailed discussions around the public service and the economic policies for later this afternoon. Great questions, good answers. Please join me. Thank you.